On the air everywhere, this is New England Broadcasting.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Welcome to the Ron Van Dam Show. Hold on tight, things can get a bit weird, if you like that sort of thing.
Hold on tight.
Whatever.
Oh, God. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. It's the Ron Van Dam Show. Hey, how you doing? Welcome to the program. My name is indeed Ron Van Dam. How you doing? Good to see you, baby. Hey, baby. Hey, what's up, girl? What's up, girl? Looking good today, man. Oh, you are looking so good.
What are you wearing? What are you wearing? What are you wearing today? What are you wearing? What are you wearing? What are you wearing today?
Well, let's start with some undergarments. And put your stuff on top of that, and you got yourself an outfit, baby. Anyway, I remember my mother used to dress me, not like that. She used to take my clothes out the night before. This is when I was a little kid. I would be like 5 years old or something. I couldn't pick stuff out. I couldn't even reach the hangers in the closet or anything. I don't even think I had hangers in the closet. I was only 5 years old. My mother would put the stuff out, and I remember, this is interesting, because most people don't remember this kind of stuff. This is the kind of stuff I remember. My mother used to put me in clothes that I absolutely hated. She used to dress me up like some kind of a little Mr. Potato Head or something. It was made of styrofoam. It was awful. And I remember walking around saying to myself, oh, I hope nobody looks at me because I look horrendous. I had a fashion sense like at 4 or 5 years old, I do recall. And what are these red overalls? Red, and you can see my knees. What are you doing to me? Am I your laughing boy? Am I your little laughing boy? What are you doing? And I remember people saying, oh, he looks so cute. He looks so cute. And I was saying to myself, no, I don't. No, I don't. I look like a dysfunctional little wooden piece of crap is what I look like. I love my mother dearly. Wonderful, wonderful woman. We all love our mothers. Some of us, actually, I've met people that say, my mother's a bastard and she's a bitch and everyone talked to her. I guess that happens too. But for the most part, we all hold them, you know, they gave birth to me and they swaddled me and they put their breast upon my mouth and I ate the food and they took care of me and they worked 10 jobs in order for me to put a piece of bread in my mouth and this is just wonderful. She sacrificed her entire life for me. And for the most part, that's usually true, but it's, you know, that's what you do. That's what you do. But my mother did two things that were, I wouldn't call them abusive, they were just not right. One of them was the way that she dressed me. I don't know what she was thinking, I don't know what catalog she was looking at, man, but she kind of like dressed me up like Pinocchio half the time, and it was awful. I was made of wood. Is that all you think of me, that I'm made of wood? The other thing is that she couldn't cook. She just couldn't cook. She just couldn't cook. And I make fun of it as I do these podcasts and all the radio stuff. I make fun of people who say that they can't cook. My mother indeed could not cook. I don't think she knew what a recipe was. Here's what she did with everything. She would take whatever it was, a slab of meat, a potato, a pea, anything at all, a table napkin, and she'd set the oven to 350. It was like the oven didn't even have to have other settings on it. What's the point of 375? What's the point of 425 broiling? I don't know what that is. It was 350 for everything. And she had this pan that looked like it was so weathered. It was like it was around from the Stone Age, this pan. And because everything, every day was the pan. And she would put whatever it was on this pan, shove it in the oven at 350, and just let it go until the fire department came or something like that. Or someone said, excuse me, is that something in the oven? Oh, yeah, whatever. Everything was baked at 350. It's amazing that I have any kind of great love for food, because as I grew up, I'm kind of like a closet chef. I cook in the closet. Thank you. No, I love to cook. I cook every day. I love it. I love it. I do. I'd open up a restaurant if I wasn't so damn lazy, but I am, so that ain't going to happen. That's a lot of work, man. That's a lot of work, man, dude. That's a lot of work, dude. So she baked everything, and as a result, I just hated her cooking, and my brother and I remember sitting at the kitchen table, and what she loved to make for some odd reason, and I don't understand why I'm not totally screwed up. I am a little screwed up, totally, though. She loved liver, and to me, putting anything in a pan and shoving it in the oven that is representative of some organ that's in your body is not really too tasty to me. She did this. Now, we had another thing she liked besides the liver, and I hated the liver. Who likes liver? Raise your hand if you like liver. Just a slab of liver, and you're sick. You're sick. You're sick if you just like a slab of liver. There's something wrong with you. You're a cannibal. You're one of those Walking Dead people there. That's what you are. The other thing she loved to throw in the oven at 350, which was everything, spaghetti, everything. Everything was 350 baked in the oven. It was unbelievable, man. Sarah, I'm not kidding you either. For years, I used to travel around, and you go to these little towns, and there'd be a sign outside of a restaurant and say, home cooking, good old home cooking, and I turn the car around and go, no, not home cooking, not things baked at 350, no! Home cooking, no, not for me, man. That's not an inviting sign for me. That's like the devil worship sign. Home cooking, no! I'm going out because I don't want home cooking. If I wanted home cooking, I'd stay at home. Home cooking my ass. I'm home cooking my ass right now. Anyway. So where was it? So the other thing she did besides the liver was the tongue, a cow's tongue. And I think it's a cow's liver too. I'm really not sure. She would take the cow's tongue and put it in the pan at 350, and then she served that with mustard, so at least there was like something to put on it. But you cannot eat. Have you ever had tongue before? No, not like that. Yeah, I know. I've had tongue. Yeah, I've had tongue. This is a cow's tongue, and it's porous like a tongue. And you cut it with a knife, and you put it in your mouth, and you're supposed to eat the tongue. And it's like, my tongue is touching another tongue. It's like, no, that's not good. I don't know, in many cultures you eat stranger things than a tongue. But for like a 5-6-year-old kid, no. So what I used to do was, I used to take the food that my mother served me, and I would take a napkin. My mother thought I was the neatest, most you know, etiquette guy in the world, because I would always put a napkin in my lap when I ate dinner. That's not why I did that. It's because I could take the food off the plate, cut it into little pieces, and shove it into my crotch with a napkin. And then I'd say, look, Mom, I'm all finished. Oh, do you want more? Oh, no! Oh, no! I'm full. And then I would go upstairs to the bathroom, and yeah, I'd throw the napkin with the food in it into the toilet. You know, that theory works really well until the day, and I recall it greatly, when there was so much of that freaking meat that it wouldn't go down the toilet bowl and it started backing up. And at that moment, I don't know how old I was, but I saw my life flash in front of me, and it hadn't been a long life at that point, but I saw all of it. It was all fairly fresh in my mind. My father came running upstairs because he heard like the toilet going, and he ran in and he said, "What are you doing?" And I really felt like saying, "Hey, you eat her food. What do you want from me?" But I didn't, because I couldn't, because he was married to her. And he was pissed. And in those days, when they were pissed, they didn't say, "Go to your room and think about what you did." They didn't do that. They said, "Go to your room. I'm coming in with objects that are going to come into great impact with your ass." And they would, and they did. And my father would always say, "This is going to hurt you more than it's going to hurt me." And I said, "Dad, don't you have that backwards? Aren't you supposed to say, 'This is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you'?" And he said, "No, I mean it the other way. It's going to hurt you more. I'm not hitting myself." So like, duh. Smart man. He's a smart man. Smart man. An honest man. And that's what I'm wearing.
What are you wearing? What are you wearing? What are you wearing today? Today. What are you wearing? What are you wearing? What are you wearing today? Today.
I don't know. I don't know what I'm wearing. But I sure would like a beverage.
When you reach for a beer, what are you looking for? The finest malts, grains, and hops. An artisan ale that represents a modern take on traditional brewing techniques that master brewers have refined and treasured for years. A true beer drinking experience. Or like most of us, are you just looking to get fucked up on the cheap? Well, if you're like the rest of us, congratulations, your beer is here. It's Falkenhalter. It's not a great beer. It's not even a good beer. It's a beer that's $4 a case, and it's strong enough to melt the chrome off a trailer hitch. So kiss your liver goodbye and say hello to Falkenhalter. It's beer.
What's up? What's up, homegirl? I don't know what that means. I have no idea what homegirl means. People say it, so I repeated it. I was talking to somebody yesterday, and she told me that the Kardashians were the Antichrist. And I said, "Yeah, and, like, what's the revelation there? What happened to Bruce Jenner, man? I mean, I understand that there are some people who want to become the opposite sex of what they are, a man wanting to become a woman, vice versa. I mean, I don't get it, but I understand that that's a possibility. But in Bruce Jenner's case, man, what the hell happened to him, man? What, he used to run a decathlon or something? Or did he fall down and trip on his face or something? What caused him to be... What is that about, man? And what does that say for, like, Kim Kardashian? Like, she's a fairly... not Kim. Kim's the girl, isn't it? Yeah, Kim's the daughter with the big ass or... I don't know. I don't even look at her. I have no idea what the deal is with her. She's attractive, and then she's married to... I don't know. What's wrong with attractive people? Why do they always marry losers? What is that about? You know, it's like, I'm attractive, so I have to ruin my life because I have it too good. Is that what they do? Is that what they say? I don't know what happens there. I don't understand what happens there. I don't understand. I get it. What's the Mama Kardashian there? What's Carol Kardashian? I don't know what the fuck her name is, but not an ugly person or something. And she drove her husband there... Bruce Jenner to change his sex, man. I mean, that's like, must have like really been really, really bitchy to drive a guy to become a woman. Like, all right, I've had enough of your crap. I'm changing sexes, man, because if you're representative of the sex that I liked, I'm out of here, man. I'm changing sexes. I'm going to do something a little different today. First of all, I want to tell you about some stuff coming up that I'm fairly excited about. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to speak to a guy named Gerard Artsen, all the way from Holland. Yeah. We'll be doing a live thing from, like, Holland. That in itself is, like, cool. He is going to tell us that the Earth has got to be saved rather soon. Otherwise, we're going to, like, destroy this planet, which I think most of us agree with. But he's actually saying that there are alien beings from other planets that visit us on a continual basis and shall save the Earth. And I thought, man, I gotta have this conversation. Now, he's been on the show before, and we've talked to some of his colleagues before. It's fascinating subject matter, and if you just open up your mind a little bit, it is interesting. And see where you fall in the belief system with this. About alien beings from other planets. Yeah, we'll talk about that on tomorrow's show. It's a fascinating interview. We did it this morning, and it'll air tomorrow. It'll be interesting. And then on the next day, on Friday, we're going to have as a guest Vicki Lawrence from the Carol Burnett Show. She'll be joining us, and Tori Wainwright, the lovely Tori, will be joining us for that interview as well. So that's Thursday and Friday of this week on this program. Today, I'm going to speak to a guy who wrote a book called Missing Persons, and it's not about Liam Neeson. It's about time someone wrote a book. He's saying that what he's doing is he's going back in his life, and he's looking at his young adulthood and his childhood, when life really, like, there's a lot of life that occurs between the ages of 16 and 22. It's like tons of things happen every minute in that age group thing. You know, I mean, it's just like you have your first this, you have your first that. You experience, like, love and hate, and you learn, like, so much in the space of those, what, 6-7 years. And what he does is he reflects back to see what made him what he is today. And it's a fascinating kind of social, psychological look back. And as he talks about it, we start to connect to it. If you're old enough to connect to something like that, I mean, if you're 20 years old, then, like, no, you won't. But you might. You might connect back to high school, which was like yesterday for you. But it's an interesting thing, Missing Persons. And we're going to speak to him right now, as a matter of fact. I'm going to get him on the old jukebox here. I have to put a dime in, because other than that, I really can't afford to do this. Bruce Pasecki is Missing Persons is going to join us right now. Bruce! I'm speaking to Bruce Pasecki, who is the best-selling author of Doing More with Less, if you remember that. And he's back again. This is Missing Persons, A Life of Unexpected Influences. It's a fascinating book. Bruce joins us now. What part of the country are you in right now?
I'm in the wonderland of Saratoga Springs, where it's snowy and sunny.
Yeah. Well, kind of like the Boston area, where we've been buried by snow. So I guess you get somewhat of a taste of what's going on here in this area.
Yeah. You got to take those snowshoes out, and I have an old thumb from writing too many books, Ron. So snow raking my slate roof.
Oh,
I tell 100 stories at night when I'm watching the Celtics play.
Yeah, I don't understand. Well, hey, if it's going to be a rough winter, what better way to get through it than to read a book that's fun? And this is it here. I have it in front of me. It's fascinating. It's I like the subtitle, A Life of Unexpected Influences. What does that mean?
Yeah, you know, a friend of mine who's a Vermonter, Jay Perini, has written 26 books, and wow. he wrote The Last Station, the great movie starring Helen Mirren,
yep.
and he wrote the intro to Missing Persons, and he got me thinking. I had written the book, you know, since the birth of my daughter, and it's the 70 different vignettes, and I decided that so many of the most magical and important people in my life who feed me every day, who help me enjoy the sun or the snow, mm-hmm. are missing. My father died when I was 3. Mm-hmm. My mother passed away in the act of writing this book.
Wow.
My daughter, who I write a lot about in this book, called The Discovery of Colette, as if in having her birth come into my life,
yeah.
I discovered an entirely new continent on Earth. So I wrote Missing Persons as Missing Persons, and then the publisher who came up to buy my next 4 books,
mm-hmm.
an amazing publisher by the name of Rudy Shore, came up with the subtitle, A Life of Unexpected Influences. And I believe, Ron, he came up with that title because in many ways my life is a rags to reflection life. It's sort of Ben Franklin all over again, in the sense that a lot of unexpected good fortune happened to me because of the people I happened to meet. One quick case, I already referred to Rudy Shore, the publisher, but way back when I was young and angry, a very typical angry young man, you know, no father, immigrant mother has $27 in the bank.
Yeah.
My mother starts temporarily taking in foster children and caring for them so that we have food and clothing income. And I had grown up with Puerto Rican brothers. I write in this book about Edwin Torres. I had a Chinese sister,
mm-hmm.
Su Ying Chang. And so when the publisher, who had read Doing More with Less and knew that it was a Ben Franklin story, I built a corporation that works for many large corporations, and I have a lot of talented staff on my team.
Mm-hmm.
Rudy said, well, you got to talk about where you came from. How did that happen? And the word we chose was unexpected and influences, because in a way, Ron, the inner power of a memoir is almost like a fable. It's somewhat poetic in that you are telling the truth about who influenced you,
right.
but you're telling it in an unexpected way. So I think that's where the title comes from.
Okay. Do you find that as you got older, I don't know how old you are, but do you find that as you got older, you became more introspective and more reflective?
Yes. And there's all kinds of, I was a man of action, you know, from 10 to 22, I probably dribbled a basketball excessively, even when I was shopping for food for my mother and, you know, by the railroad tracks, I would be dribbling with one of the hands just to practice lefty, you know, and I did get to college, played for Lefty Drysdale at University of Maryland, I write about that. You know, trying to guard against people I couldn't keep up with that were freaky, like Earl of Pearl Monroe.
Uh-huh.
Or I could run beside Kevin Loggery, who was a pro in the Baltimore Bullets at the time. So I played as a young man on scholarship in the Big Ten in 2 summer camps. And then my high school teacher said, Bruce, you know, you're not only an angry young man. So he kind of confused me for a couple of months, and he said, you should apply to serious colleges.
Uh-huh.
And I said, what you're talking about, Mr. Charles Plumer? And I wound up getting scholarships from both Dartmouth and Cornell, and wound up going to Cornell, where there was a magical, unexpected influence, where people started treating my mind as useful and radiant, uh-huh. as opposed to just my body
uh-huh.
as skilled.
Yes.
You see what I mean?
Yes.
So I went from being a hoop player. That's why I wrote my book, Doing More with Teams, is that I also found a lot of influence in team play,
mm-hmm.
Ron.
Interesting. Okay. So when you sit down and you go through various facets of your life, are these the facets that were of the most influence, or the ones that are the most humorous, stood out the most?
Yeah, I'm glad you catch it. I'm glad you catch the humor in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think there's a couple things going on, and I divide the book into 3 parts. Please let me finish your question, because I don't want to anticipate mm-hmm. the question, but I think you picked up on the humor, which is really good.
Yeah, I was wondering what part of those influences did you go for, or was it a microcosm of everything?
Yeah, good question. I decided to write the book through the lens of youth,
mm-hmm.
through the lens of middle age, and then through the fear and fascination of surviving into excessive old age, because I am now 60,
mm-hmm.
and I remember when my father died, and I heard all the family stories where one of my uncles, a janitor, a lovely man I write about in this book, said, you know, Bruce, your father checked out at the right time at 39. As you get older, it always gets worse.
Really? And
so I heard all these stories about... So I wrote about the grace of youth, about the good fortune of youth, about the surprise and lust of youth, in about 20 vignettes. Their story is one is called Hurricane Sandy, about a woman I've known for a long time. She's edited my last six books and is a friend of my wife now.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote about when I first met her at Cornell. She was a grad student. I write about some trespass with a woman called Mary Beth, who was a cheerleader on my team. So this is about the lust and grace and good fortune of youth.
Mm-hmm.
I make the argument, Ron, that as you approach 60, and it probably happens for different people at different years,
mm-hmm.
unless you reconcile your relationship to that youth, unless mm-hmm. you understand what the experiences meant,
right.
and the act of writing helps me do that, you kind of live in an innocence, a kind of Bruce Springsteen, Glory Days type innocence,
yeah,
which is not really accurate, because the middle of the life, is I write of it as a long plateau. Part two is,
it's
called the sensual middle, where, you know, a good conversation, lovely events out at a great play, having the good fortune of a wife and a family. These are all features of the central middle. And at the same time, Ron, because I'm trying to write a book that's about every man, I'm not trying to say that I've had a formula that I can do the masculine 50 Shades of Grey, because it's not really only about the beginning.
Right.
It's about the maturing into a middle where you are a little overweight, where you definitely have lost your sports edge. You're not able to block the shots you used to block.
Yeah.
You have five knee surgeries, Ron, which is the story of my life.
Well, because you're
so I think
sports,
this is the story of every man in a way.
It is. Every man, it is, yes. It's interesting, and I relate to everything you're saying. It seems that all the significant parts of my life that shaped, molded me, gave me enjoyment, gave me sorrow, gave me interest, all happened in the space of about 8 years. Between maybe 18 and 23, every moment was significant and of great epic importance and memory. After that, like around 25, it was like you get into that middle part that lasts like decades and decades, but seems to be like insignificant and fleeting. It's a very interesting dichotomy of the two eras in one's life.
And then there's the paradox that I'm totally with you, Ron, and this is part of what I reflected on missing persons.
Mm-hmm.
In you relate to the enjoyments of youth, you discover solution sets
mm-hmm.
that are not as passionate and epic and overwhelming as the avalanche of youth, and you're in this long plateau, but you finally become, when you're lucky and when you reconcile your memories, you can become more content. And so what I decided to do was to write a book where the vignettes add up not to acquiescence and defeat, but to a stranger, more magical, ongoing triumph of the self, because the self gets dispersed into family and firms and history and all these other things that you couldn't understand in the selfishness of youth. And so there is a little bit of a reflection about force. So if the first third is about grace, you know, the good fortune of having been born poor and having to earn my keep, and then the middle part is about force. And I got to tell you, Ron, on the section about the humor in the book, there were some times where I had to look at my middle age beyond the force of being a businessman, and it almost became like a farce. So there's tensions in the book about the discovery of how long middle age is.
Yeah, I get that. I kind of feel like the youth was like, you're going to go on a trip, hang on, I don't know what's around the corner, but here we go. And middle age was more like, I'm more in control of this, I'm too much in control, there's no more here we go, because if I don't make it happen, we ain't going anywhere. And maybe that was
the difference. Let me tell you some of the people, I hear you, but let me tell you some of the things that, again, make this a book about unexpected surprises. Uh-huh. So I'm going to just rattle through some of the characters in these 70 vignettes, and then I'm going to talk about how they convinced me that life is not a locked door,
all right,
but that in a way life responds to you. So it's something bigger than me by far, and it's something more interesting than me. So, you know, I'm just going to rattle off the names of the characters so that as I talk with you about, you can see that I'm contemplating respect and relationships and the kind of spider web of reputation. Mm-hmm. So the most poetic pieces are without a doubt about Colette, just the pleasure of being a father as well as the obligation of it. Velissima is one of the characters, which is a made-up name because my wife is very private, and so I had to write this creative memoir with great respect that, number one, Ron, she's smarter than I am. Number two, she's Sicilian, and if I didn't do Velissima right,
Don't even go there.
Right? So I write a lot about Velissima in Wonderland and how she coped and dealt with me. I write about Jay, who is this dear friend and the writer of these 26 books. I write at length about Lillian, my mother, the factory worker who taught me a lot about competition. I write about Walter, you know, the ex-military man who dies at 39. Mm-hmm. I write about my surrogate father, Uncle Ziggy, who, you know, had a son playing football at Notre Dame and used to call up the operator when I was a kid. You know, I could imagine Lily Tomlin at the other end, Ron. And I write about it this way, where my Uncle Ziggy goes, "Hello, madam. This is Uncle Zygmunt calling collect for Zygmunt Jaszewski." And you hear the click because his son is called the same name as he is.
Yes.
But he's calling collect to himself. And I write about, you know, my Uncle Steve. I write about these my cousin Stephen, who calls me Cousin Big Head because, you know, he thought of me as an athlete and he finds out that I have a big head. Mm-hmm. And in the end, what I've concluded, and some of the reviewers are saying this, that this is a reflection in middle age about how life responds to you, that if you're open to the unexpected,
that's true,
despite the deep routine, there's a magic and surprise to it, as well as a challenge.
You're absolutely right. It is. It's how you set yourself up in your environment. And it's not, you know, a lot of people write books about how to be more successful and how to make things happen, which is like, you know, a selling seminar kind of thing. But what really is true is that if you put yourself in a certain frame of mind, then people will bring you to where you want to go. You don't really have to do it yourself. I find that very fascinating.
That's the magic, isn't
it? Yeah, it is.
That, when you discover that social momentum, that kind of, it's a little uplifting.
It is uplifting.
If you only stay within the clanging echo of the self, it becomes despairing.
Yeah.
But when you wrap yourself into that larger setting,
it's true.
It gets you through.
It's true.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, people will leave you alone when you act like that, and people will embrace you when you act differently. And yeah, I've learned that. Of course, it took me a long time to learn it, just like you. So the characters in your book are the people that you've known. Do you play a little bit beyond the fringe of who they really are and accentuate their personalities? Or, I mean, how far do you go with that?
That's a great question. It's the great question of the day because we all have watched Brian Williams. Uh-huh. NBC Universal is one of the 41 companies that are affiliated with my company.
Oh.
You know, we do benchmarking of leaders within companies like Toyota and NBC Universal and Shell and Canada's largest company. So the irony of the question, the thing that's so true, is that in memory, when memory becomes larger than identity,
mm-hmm.
you do understand there's some revision occurring there and some embellishment, mm-hmm. right? So I think it's true that when I think of my mother now at 60, I think she's more heroic than when I was pissed off at her.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I think a Brian Williams gets in trouble because he creates a false heroics where he's saying, I'm the guy in the helicopter when this stuff went down, mm. right? When the actual reality of living is that some days of youth stay golden forever, you can cash in on that gold with a little embellishment,
sure.
With a little savoring of it. You're entitled to it because you survived.
And right.
You might have even flourished. So the thing that I try and make it real in this book, and that's with the humor and the irony,
yeah.
is I do believe that memory becomes larger than identity.
Probably.
We live in a century where everybody, Ron, focuses on the ego, right?
Uh-huh.
But I experience in this book that the best way to write memoir is to write respectfully and dramatically about those that influenced you. And
true.
So when they gave me the contract after the bestsellers to write this book, I decided, hell, I'm not going to write an ordinary memoir. He did this with this ego on West 57th Street.
Right.
Instead, I wanted to write about the people I've chose to love and care for that have made me who I am.
Yes, but you, I mean, I've read your book and I've talked to you before. You are an entertainer, whether you know it or not. And, of course, when you're a writer, you are an entertainer. I think even Brian Williams might be put under that category, and he became that when he started doing talk shows and being guests on talk shows, which he did a lot of within the past few years. When you become an entertainer, something inside you makes you want to be more interesting than you think you actually are. So I don't see anything wrong with that at all, to be honest with you. And then there are documentarians who write books, and those are interesting too, but they're not entertainers. So I kind of get that. I think you were placed on the earth to relate stories and feelings and explanations in an entertainment sense.
Well said. And okay. I thank you for that, because as someone who's read Missing Persons, mm-hmm. you're giving the reader an advanced glimpse into how it is.
Yeah.
Entertaining to read. When I was a businessman only, you know, before I became this popular writer,
right.
I felt, like Ben Franklin, that my obligation was to be informative,
mm-hmm.
methodical, and persuasive. Mm-hmm. In other words, my job was to make companies perform better
right.
in any limited way I could.
Right.
I think that in the act of writing Missing Persons, of discovering how to write in color and in vignettes and in a lively way, you're exactly right. Mm-hmm. There is this element of being informative, persuasive, and entertaining. I want to tell you one story that I learned that was legit when I was still a basketball player in high school, playing my fourth year in varsity in League One on Long Island. I had a great coach, a guy called Coach Smith, who, unlike Mr. Plumer, who said, you know, you're not just an angry young man, you know, Mr. Plumer also says to me in this book, and there were years between a little vignette when he first said, you're not just an angry man, and then he said, someday you'll be a good father. And I got to tell you, Ron, when I was a sports fiend in the early phase of my life, I did not think of becoming a father. Women were not something that I wanted to have a family with. And yet, you read this book, and I celebrate the strong valor of women, from my wife, my mother, my daughter, some of my best friends. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that it is entertaining to think about the meaning of women beyond sex. And there's a lot of that in this book.
Interesting. In one section of the book, which is titled The Art of Being a Dog, you kind of turn things around, because an interesting part of life is to change perspective and see the same thing in a different way. And I think that's what you do in this piece.
I would like to talk a little bit about that
yeah,
piece.
Sure.
And the first way I want to talk about it is, you know, with affection, before I try and make it into a vignette.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing to talk about regarding the care and the compassion of that section is, you know, I told you I grew up poor, but I did have a family dog who my mother let this Labrador, she let me name the Labrador. So it was the first act of creation in my life. It was a magical moment because I realized that she was giving me power for something that strayed into my backyard. It had a crooked tail because someone had locked its tail in a door and it ran from the neighborhood to our backyard. And this is a moment of affectionate good fortune because some of the things that run into my life are not perfect, but they are, in a sense, angelic. So I wanted to write this piece, which begins part two, with this reflection that what got me through life was that I was responding to the smells and the opportunities like a dog. So I want to just give your readers, if you don't mind, a 50-second
sure.
glimpse of what the style is.
Sounds good.
He had once known a dog named Zachary. Zachary would limp for affection and attention. He might be sniffing the ground, but he was always eyeing something better. Zach was a fantastic dog, warm and fuzzy, smart, and tenacious. Nonetheless, he was easily distracted by a new smell or a new thought. Even squirrels could change instantly his calculating equations, and he'd sprint off, forgetting that limp that had gotten him attention in the first place. In youth, and even in middle age, there were so many ways in which he felt like Zach. He felt himself exactly like a dog. For years, he thought that this was because he had come into the world poor, with little advantage except his senses and his wit. But now, in middle age, he knew better. Colette thought that her dad man had been a bear in another life because you protect your cubs, she said, and because you are big and cuddly. Not really, he thought. The deeper, less romantic truth was that he was a dog. No adults really felt him to be a bear, and while he loved his young Artemis daughter, he felt that she exaggerated both his size and his reach. One last section from this. His animal spirit was reflective of his deep nature. What was funny was that they, the public, kept feeding him, kept prompting him. Opponents on the basketball court, whenever he caught them in a fake, called him a dog. Early business partners like Robin, who owned paintings by Rembrandt, paused when he bought him out to call him a dog. When he met his investors' obligations and left the world of debt before the age of 40, some had called him un-American, but most called him behind his back another white Cornell-bred dog. They were usually from the better breed of schools like Harvard, INSEAD, or the London School of Economics, and their deans and their faculty had come from similar pedigrees. He took no offense in this, but he did, as he did on the basketball court, he chose to make their offense the object of his skill. So I go on, you know, reflecting on the fact that if you're sensual, if you're competitive, if you want that squirrel, the beginning of life is dog-like. Mm-hmm. And maybe the maintenance of passion and endurance in life is to remain dog-like. So I don't make a big thing out of this. I try and keep it at the level that I experienced it.
Cool. It's called Missing Persons, The Life of Unexpected Influences. It's vignettes, stories of all different types of those that are missing from Bruce's life, yet have been profound influences, as Bruce's book may be a profound influence on your life. Ooh, huh? The book's available everywhere, I assume. Is that right, Bruce?
Everywhere? That is, yeah. Okay. Amazon, Barnes & Noble's, a couple hundred independent bookstores, oh, Ron. Thanks for offering.
Now, what if somebody
wanted... And if you go to doingmorewithlessbook.com, you get a sense of the tradition of the books.
That's what I'm talking about. So that's your website.
Is that doingmorewithlessbook.com, yes.
Okay. And is there a website, like, for you, like, entirely of all your writings?
Sure. Well, yeah, I would like some of the listeners to check out this team of change agents we created. Mm-hmm. You can go to AHC Group, American Hazard Control Group.com. There is one based on my name, but like I start the book, no one could pronounce my name.
Yeah, well, yeah, they'll learn how to spell it.
That's why I went to the other things.
Okay. Let me sell Bruce's last name in case you want to Google him, because that's what we do with you, with people. We Google them. P-I-A-S-E-C-K-I. Google that, and you'll find out all the stuff he's doing, where you can contact him as well. Bruce, it's been a pleasure doing an extended interview with you. We'll get a little more inside on what's going on with you, and I'm sure we'll be talking again.
I appreciate your attention here. Be well, everybody. We'll see you soon.
Take care. Bye-bye. Thanks, Bruce. Have yourselves a wonderful day. I'll be with you again tomorrow, same time, whatever.